now afternoon. Thank you so much for coming to this workshop on security and privacy for new internet applications. My name is Gus Hossain, and I'm a visiting senior fellow at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and I am going to chair this workshop. We are incredibly fortunate, and I'm honored to be sitting beside some of the people here today who have been incredibly willing to engage in this very important topic. And I will present their biographies in a moment, but I just want to give you some background as to what this workshop's about and why we're running it. Back in at the Athens workshop, at the Athens meeting of the IGF last year, we were alarmed that the discussion on security had focused so much on cybersecurity and hadn't looked at security as a more holistic definition. And so we organized a workshop at that point with members from industry, from government, and civil society, and there was a very rich discussion that took place. So when the opportunity arose to run another workshop at this meeting, we thought, how can we move the discussion forward even further? So we decided to look particularly at what is considered new internet applications, the old internet applications being the simple operations such as mail and web browsing. But we're moving towards different types of services. We have the Web 2.0 services that usually involve user-generated content and blogging and social networking, but we're also moving towards different types of applications. Some people refer to cloud computing, where your data is no longer on your laptop or on your desktop, but reside elsewhere. And as we're moving to these advanced internet applications, there are legal ramifications, social ramifications, and regulatory ramifications that need to be discussed. And to date, we have not had that discussion in many fora. So I look forward to the workshop today to bring out some of the key issues here and to try to understand how complex this field actually is. So as I said, we're incredibly lucky and fortunate to have the speakers we have today, and I'll introduce each of them in order of their presentation. To begin with, we have Anne Carblanc. Anne is from the OECD, and she's the official responsible for policy issues related to the security of information systems and networks and the protection of privacy. Prior to joining the OECD, she was Secretary General of the French Data Protection Authority, the CNIL. She had previously served in the French judicial system as a judge in charge of criminal investigations and as the head of the criminal legislative unit in the Ministry of Justice. After Anne, we're going to have Joanna Shelton. Joanna serves as the policy counsel and legislative strategist for Google in Washington, D.C. Joanna joined Google in June 2007 after serving as senior counsel for telecommunications and the internet for the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Energy and Commerce. Her portfolio included all telecommunications, internet, and media issues before the committee. She previously served as a legal advisor for broadcast and cable issues to the Federal Communications Commission and as a counsel for a U.S. member of the House of Representatives, focusing on broadband and intellectual property. Before that, she was an attorney with the Federal Communications Commission's Common Carrier Bureau and at Latham & Watkins in Washington, D.C. She is also clerk for a judge in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Following Joanna, we're going to have Simon Davies. Simon's a colleague of mine at the LSE, and he's considered one of the world's leading privacy advocates. Having worked in the field for over 20 years, and he hates it when I remind people of the fact he's been in this field for over 20 years, he has led campaigns in a number of countries around the world on issues varying from national ID cards, telecommunications privacy, financial surveillance, and visual surveillance. He is a director of Privacy International, a London-based human rights organization, and as I said, he's a visiting senior fellow at the London School of Economics and Political Science. We're missing one of our speakers who might be in the main panel, so I will introduce Carlos when he actually does arrive. But the last speaker we're going to have for today will be Marie Georges. Marie is from the French privacy regulator, La Commission Nationale de l'Informatique et des Libertés. There she is responsible for work in advanced studies, development, and cooperation. She's originally an economist, but we won't hold that against her. She previously worked at the Institut National de Recherche en Informatique et en Automatique, which is the National Institute of Research in Computer Science and Automation, and as an executive engineer. which we won't hold against her as well. She joined the CNIL in 1979, working in areas including privacy and policing, financial privacy, privacy of social and medical affairs, and telecommunications privacy. She worked with the European Commission on the development of the European Directive on Data Protection that eventually resulted in the Directive of 1995, and the Complementary Directive on Data Protection and Privacy in the Telecommunications Sector from 1997. So, an incredibly illustrious panel, and I have asked the panelists to keep their original presentations, initial presentations, relatively short, because we're hoping to have discussion, a very participatory panel, if that's possible. So please start framing your questions, and once the presentations are done, we'll start. We'll open up the discussion to the floor to move forward. So, to start, I'm going to pass over to Anne Carblanc.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. I'm going to open the discussion by speaking to the slide which is up there on the screen, trying to show what we witness at the OECD, but not only there, everywhere, as being the new environment, which in fact represents challenges to privacy and data protection. First of all, new technologies bring dramatic changes. What are we thinking about? Thinking about storage, which becomes less and less expensive, about data transfers, which are nearly instantaneous and free, about ever more powerful, ubiquitous, and cheap processing tools, RFID sensors being search engines, location-based services. The fact that systems for managing identities are increasingly being deployed with interoperability on the line of horizon, and services oriented around the knowledge of a consumer location, which will increasingly be available on mobile devices. The second element that we can witness is that fueled by technological advance, the trends in globalization are the following. Data transfers in many different areas like human resources, financial services, education, electronic commerce, health research are now an integral part of the global economy. And then data flows allow a global distributed approach to tasks which takes advantage of expertise in multiple locations around the world and around the clock. We also see changing user behaviors and attitudes. The development of simple yet powerful applications for individuals to create and to distribute information, often personal information, is a key aspect of the Web 2.0 phenomenon. Huge numbers of individuals are blogging, posting pictures, videos, interacting with large groups of friends or the public through social networking sites. The resulting behavior changing are altering the assumption on which privacy principles are predicated. Personal data is often created and volunteered by individuals rather than requested and collected by organizations. And this private information, this is something that really strikes me, is more and more often stored at a distance, out of control of the individuals. And this information is very often disseminated by other individuals across the network. So one question to all of us would be, are we seeing a generational shift in attitudes to privacy or not? Changes also in the behavior of businesses and other organizations are worth noting. The public sector is increasingly using information, including personal information, which has been collected for their missions, and they use them in a commercial context. There are data mining techniques, web analytical software. Marketers can really conduct behavioral and targeted segmentations. Price discrimination is an example. And those changes result in more privacy risks, both to individuals and also to organizations, while bringing far greater business efficiencies and convenience to users, many of the developments bring changes in privacy risks as well. Just the sheer volume of personal data being transferred and risks related to secondary usage, well, the list is very long. Information breaches. So when we look at this new environment and we look at the instruments that we've been working with and are still working with pretty well, but maybe not that well enough, which have been developed in the late 70s and which have been replicating one another from the Council of Europe Convention, the OECD guidelines, to the UN principles, to the European directive, with always more details, more maybe, I wouldn't say bureaucracy, but maybe bureaucracy too. All these instruments at international level on which national laws are based look basically the same. You can take the APEC privacy framework. It has also taken its inspiration in this series of instruments. There are differences, but nevertheless. So we see these policy and legal frameworks becoming to age. We see businesses having a lot of difficulties complying in all countries when they are doing business across countries. We see new technologies, biometrics, privacy-enhancing technologies, protection of digital identities, privacy impact assessments, which are not in those international frameworks and laws. And maybe we would need to think about that. Then there are other legal questions. Is notice and consent or knowledge still the appropriate way to guarantee that people are people's personal information will be collected? Aren't we putting too much on the end on the you know on the end of the user, the individual user? Recent efforts even are showing limits, like the EU, United States safe harbor, or the binding corporate rules. Even recent efforts like the London Initiative, even the OECD recommendation for cross-border enforcement, all these instruments have limits. So what we think at the OECD, but not only at the OECD, in the different regions, in the region of APEC, within the European Union, is that, and not only in the public sector, but also not only data protection authorities, but also among NGOs and privacy advocates, and the private sector, is that maybe we need to think about how to protect privacy in this environment. I'm going to be provocative, we shouldn't pretend any longer that all these instruments are perfectly adequate. They are still very good, all the principles are valid, but in terms of implementing them, we need to really make an effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Anne. I'm now going to move on to Joanna Shelton from Google.
Thank you. And thanks for having us on this panel so we can give our perspective. I think many of you are familiar with Google's mission to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. But you may not be as familiar with our privacy principles that the company upholds. First, we build protections into products from the very ground up, privacy protections. We incorporate user choice wherever it's possible for the product or application or service that's being developed. We have no products that use any personal data unless we have disclosed that in a very clear manner to the users. We always ask for opt-in to services that are going to use sensitive data, and we do have some of those services, including credit card information on Google's checkout product. We have policies that we strive for simple and clear language, easily accessible in places in using non-legal speak, very, very clear. We allow people to use a lot of our services anonymously, which we have found people appreciate. Obviously, our core product, the online advertising product, raises some of these issues. Advertising, we has turned out to be just a critical function of the whole web's ecosystem and the internet's ability to thrive and to be the vibrant and robust and global platform that we all appreciate and take from it, what we, you know, for our own personal communities and broader communities. Obviously, users have been able to find more useful and more relevant products or services that they're looking for through the type of advertising that we provide. It enables new voices to be found. It certainly enables small and medium-sized and micro-sized entities to really have an ability to participate in commerce in a way that they hadn't before. And it allows innovation to occur, the ability to take the advertising product and see where else we can go with it, which, as our company, likes to go in lots of different directions with that. We have found as a company that advertising is most responsible and it's most effective when it respects the user's choice and it's relevant and it's timely. We do not like to deliver bad advertisements. We think that that does more harm to the overall ecosystem. And so there are plenty of times when you do searches on Google and there are no ads that come up at all. So we like to make sure that we have, from the very beginning of Google, we have had standards in terms of what we allow and not allow for advertising. We recognize very much that user trust is the core asset of any internet company, in particular Google, and that will be absolutely continue as we go into a world of more vibrant cloud computing, a proliferation of new applications, user-generated content. The user's trust is really the most fundamental asset that Google has, and it's vital for our continued success, and we are well aware of that. Keeping the user's trust, making sure that we don't do things that the users that would degrade the user's trust. We recognize that users are one click away from another search engine. There have been several other search engines in the past that were very successful in their time. AltaVista, Lycos, InfoSeek. People here at the IGF are well aware of these examples in the history. So we do recognize that users are one click away and that they're in control. Within the company, we have a team of privacy experts. We have about 16 attorneys now, growing every day, that are trained in privacy law. We have three a team of leaders that are leading on this issue. We have the attorneys work from the product design, from the ground up. They are integrated into the product design and raising a lot of questions and being advocates within the organization on privacy. I'm going to take a little bit of time to explain sort of the information that Google collects and how we protect that information, because there tends to be a lot of misinformation out there about what Google does, what we collect, and how we protect it. So with your indulgences, I'll take a little bit of time to go into that. On our main core advertising product, or search product, when people enter in queries into the Google search engine, we collect a very limited amount of information. We collect the URL, we collect with the query, we collect the IP address, we collect the time and date, we collect the operating system, we collect the browser type, and we collect the cookie ID, the basic information about the cookie. And that's it. And then how do we place an ad there? How do we target the ad to that particular query? The user enters the query. We find an ad that matches a keyword in our system. We check the language preference. This is why some of those pieces of information that we collect are useful. We check the settings and the domain. We check the IP address to get an approximate location of where that user is, because when they're searching for pizza or whatever it is they're searching for, it's most useful to them if they know if it's more tied to their particular area. Then we algorithmically rank the potential ads using a variety of factors, including the quality of that. And then there's a bid that takes place. The ad is shown, and if the user clicks on it, we are paid. So that's the general architecture of how the Google search engine works. When we place advertisements with third parties, with third party partners, it's a very similar notion. We match the ad against, this time, not the keyword that has been put into a search, but we match it against the content on the web page, just by using terminology and a very contextual check on the system, and then the same type of information is collected and used. So how do we protect this information that we do recognize that we have? First, we limit the data that we are used, that's used for targeting. As I just mentioned, we are primarily a contextual company that does not use profiling of who you might be or what you did in the past. We find it most useful that consumers are in control and putting in what they are interested in that particular time. We find that to be a very relevant measure for what they are looking for. So we limit the overall the amount of data that we are using. We limit the time that we are holding the data. As many of you know, we were the first major search engine to announce a logs policy, an 18-month logs policy. This was not an easy step for a company like Google. We are a company with a lot of engineers. I think engineers have an inherent bias that information will be useful in some capacity at some point in the future to do some kind of innovative new thing. So there was a belief that it was a very difficult step for the company to realize that they had to tell the engineers that at some point in time this information is not going to be still in our system. We also announced a 2-year cookie policy where the cookies that we collect will expire automatically after 2 years. Obviously, as a user is using our system, those cookies auto-renew, and that is something that we find it's useful in terms of keeping their language preferences, keeping their safe search settings, keeping some of the other basic information like how many results per page they prefer. Again, with the users being in able to choose and being really a part of our overall ecosystem. We also limit the disclosure of data. We generally don't transfer data to advertisers or third parties. There are exceptions to that. Obviously, check out the credit card payment system is one example. We have strict review of requests that we get for people's information. I think many of you are aware that we have a track record of fighting overreaching sort of requests by governments, including the United States in 2005 when we were subpoenaed with a request that sought billions of URLs and millions of search queries. We were the only company of 34 companies that had received that subpoena to stop and say, wait a minute, this is not right. This is overreaching and we're going to take it to court. We took it to court and we were vindicated on the principle that the government should not just have all this information for its disposal to mine through. We were told by the court to disclose 50,000 URLs rather than billions. So we thought that was a very important principle that we as a company wanted to stand by. We also protect against unauthorized access. We have data access and breach policies and trainings. We do have very strong network and physical security teams that are well aware of the need to protect this information. We continue to innovate even in the privacy area. Innovation is obviously a core mission for the company, and so we want to see where we can innovate in other areas as well. We have launched a privacy channel on YouTube. We have put our privacy practices and policies into videos, which we find some users may prefer to watch a video of our privacy policy rather than just read the information. So we have 2 videos available now. As we are contemplating moving from text advertising to other areas, we will be experimenting and hoping to innovate in the privacy space as well. We recognize that other companies, particularly some of our competitors, also collect a lot of information about their millions of users. Some may have more information than we do about hobbies and interests and activities, and some are more actively using that data to target ads through behavioral and profiling that we have to date not done as much of. So going forward, we very much appreciate the need for regimes to protect privacy while being flexible enough to allow this innovation to occur, to allow the new products and applications and services, to allow the cloud computing and the user-generated content and all the different innovations that are still to come, to allow for economic growth, to allow for the general flow of information that all societies need. We want to work together. We very much are willing and are encouraging multi-stakeholder cooperation. We agree that basic standards are needed to protect consumers globally, as long as those also protect businesses and allow them to operate and innovate. So we have advocated for creating minimum global standard built around international consensus that is flexible, technology neutral, and forward-looking. And I look forward to our discussion on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that very clear presentation. And so now I'll pass over to Simon Davies from Privacy International.
Thanks, Gus. This is probably the perfect moment for me to pick an argument with Google over its interpretation of privacy. But even the phrase international consensus won't bring me to do that. It'll be messy and protracted, and this issue goes broader, obviously, than search engines and into a much more massive sphere, which I wanted to concentrate on. And Google does play a part in this, by the way. As you'll see in the story, which I just want to tell you. Just by way of background, Privacy International, which is a small animal with very big teeth that can be quite vicious when it wants to be, has always, since the inception of the internet, always believed that there's going to be a catastrophe in the future unless the framework for privacy was well understood and respected from the very beginning. And we've always believed there is a, or has been over the last 3 years, particularly a race to the bottom involving privacy, where companies talk the talk very well on privacy, but in reality, they're going for the big game, which is, of course, ad space. And you only need to talk to companies to get a sense of how desperate they are to grab that piece of action, to grab that revenue. And really, there's no other game in town. Nothing else really matters. If privacy is or could be respected, it's largely coincidental, because in the end, it's the shareholders' interests that matter. I mean, let's just be, I'm not screaming about the, you know, the downside of commercialism here. It's just a reality that there is a perception that privacy gets in the way of profits, where every large organization is scrambling for ad revenue right now. Now, we always knew this was going to happen. So a few months ago, we undertook a study. We wanted to find out, were there organizations out there on the web that respected privacy? How bad were the ones that didn't? And could we rank them? So we did, and we ranked, I think, 23 of the major companies. Google, and we are, by the way, going to change this in the final report, but the draft report put Google as the worst respecter of privacy. I think we said endemic lack of respect for privacy. We are modifying that as we speak because of some changes to Google's policy. Now, I think in the course of the work we did, which I think covered about 6 months, one thing became very clear, that there was the reality of privacy invasion, the reality of lack of respect for privacy, and there was the perception. And in the end, the two were so intertwined it was difficult to pick one apart from the other. Because what we were getting from the companies was a very little value in terms of raw data that we could use. Statements were made by companies which were entirely incorrect, rather deceptive about their position on privacy. So we had to do a lot of deep drilling into companies to find out what was really going on. Now that, I think, is symptomatic of the big problem that we're facing, which is we don't know what's happening. There is no transparency. There is no communication. Consumers hear the rhetoric, but can't actually decide through any logical process which company provides a better and more privacy-friendly service. Hence, we released these rankings. And it became the biggest technology story of the week worldwide, partly because we'd singled out Google as the worst offender. But what we decided to do was to see what would happen if we brought all these companies together. Let's, for the first time, have a dialogue about privacy between the civil society organizations and the big internet players. And hats off to Google. They came to this meeting, which we had in Montreal 2 months ago, 3 months ago, as did Microsoft and eBay, Facebook, a whole range of others. And for the first time, we were able to sit down and talk. Now, the interesting dialogue, none of this has been public so far. We didn't go public because although people knew the fact of the meeting, it was a case of building reputation, building network, building, trying to get this thing off the ground, trying to get the trust between the parties. But what I found most interesting during this bizarre meeting was that we didn't even have a definition of privacy. So while companies are out there proclaiming their protection, that they are protectors of privacy, they don't actually have a clear definition. And there is no agreed definition across the industry. So even at that most basic framework level, we haven't taken the first step. But the good news is these companies are talking now, and bizarrely also, we're actually reaching out to companies such as Google before we speak publicly. I got a call from, I think it was New Scientist or Scientific American the other day, saying, look, what about this Project Android from Google? Now what we do is we contact the company and say, look, you give us your story, tell us the facts. Then we get back to the media, having assessed what credible data has come from the company. And that's only happened, been made possible because of this communication that now exists. Now, that's the good side of the story. I think the bad side of the story is that despite claims that these companies make, that they are privacy friendly, that they build privacy in from the outset in their product design, the reality is that the definition of privacy is so disparate that there can be no consensus. We, for example, have a definition of personal privacy which is certainly not shared by Google or many other players. You know, we believe that the aggregation of data, the capacity to profile, to collect information in new and diverse ways, creates an enormous privacy dilemma. When you go to the companies, they say, well, but if you look at each individual piece of data, that's not personal. Well, I'm sorry, yes, it is personal when it's brought together. Now, to get that message across, to get agreement that that is the case, has been a huge effort, and we've only taken the first step. I think it's going to be a long struggle, a long haul, before we finally get the ear of the industry on this subject. For example, at this meeting, there were companies that simply refused to talk to us, would not come. I think of MySpace, for example. Now, there's a company with some huge privacy problems. MySpace weren't there. Amazon weren't there. Bebo, the same. Most of them were, admittedly. Most of them want to play. They want to work to try and find a resolution. They want to work, you know, not breaching antitrust laws, but try and work together so there isn't a competitive disadvantage in creating strong privacy. But if these companies think that they're privacy friendly, they can think again. They haven't taken the first step either. You know, what we as civil society, as privacy organizations, want to see is less rhetoric and more effort put in to the actual design phase. Less rhetoric about consumer choice and control, and more actual controls. And we want to see less of a desperation and a desperate push for ad space and a little bit more respect and investment in the consumer. Now, as I say, we've taken the first step. I am encouraged by the results. But I do feel that there are dark clouds gathering. I feel that as the desperation increases to claim the vestiges of that space, the privacy message will be lost. That's something we're just going to have to wait and see. But I'm afraid it's a very mixed picture that's emerging at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you Thank you, Simon, for that very uplifting presentation. Now, Marie Georges from the French regulator, the CNIL, the Commission Nationale de l'Informatique et Liberté.
Thank you. I can endorse completely what Anne Carblanc said earlier about the characteristics that are moving today. I would just like add one thing, is that the new all new services and technologies goes, the trend is to go further deeply within intimacy of people and privacy. So the more we are going with digitalization and new services, the more we go in very private things. You just think about what you search on a search engine. Sometimes it's very, very personal things. There are literature on that. If you think about RFID being put under your skin and all these things about digital fingerprints, about video surveillance and so forth. So, right, we are good. And this is, I would say, the third level of discussion that we may have. Which society we are going to make? What we are there to? Where we are going? But for the first level and the today work, I think what Simon David just said shows the picture. We are facing new comers. Very often from countries we don't have a history on data protection, and they are discussing about privacy. Is it privacy or data protection? For us in Europe, no problem. I mean, all data related to individuals are under the scope of data protection, and I agree with you. I mean, it's so there is on this kind of subject no more discussion in Europe. And there is a big paper issued by the group of DPAs on the what is that personal data, very interesting, which was issued in the last spring. If it's true that all the rights, all the principles that had been set up in the late 70s, 80s, and few people talks about the UN principe directeur, which is very funny because adopted by the General Assembly in 90, so it's all nations. Very few people talk about it, and it's true that all these principles, because they were designed very in a coherent way with what is the risk of digitalization, and they're the same from 30 years ago that today, but there are more risks. I mean, deeper. So, but each time you have new services, maybe some principles are more in danger, I would say. For instance, and each time, and this is the job that we have, the mission data protection authorities mostly have, is to follow the new services, new technologies, and by dialogue at first, try to make people understanding, association, industry, and so forth, what is the right interpretation in the cases that coming. And if we take the new services you are talking, Gus, I would say there are several. First, people now expose themselves. It's not a collection of data from the individuals, they expose themselves. They publish things. In this kind of case, we have, because it's new public, they were not accustomed to publicize things about themselves. So our job is to show them that there are advantages, but there are some risks also, and be careful. If you publicize who you are, your picture, and so forth, and what you do, and so forth, it's not only to find your friends. Further, a boss in the future can look at that also. So take some preoccupation, have some preoccupation. So the main thing is to make people realizing what's going on and act responsibly for themselves in this situation. Well, Each new media did the same thing. Everybody knows here that there are things that you don't write, there are things that you don't say on the phone, maybe there are things that you don't write on the web. But this people needs to be accustomed. The second actor are, of course, the platform, the services. I won't say any names, but you all know them, which collect, those collect the data. You search something. If all the search requests are kept for a long time with a cookie in your device, which makes the connection all the time, and those data are collected, it is a problem, especially if those actors are becoming some kind of monopoly, because for your comfort, and because they are great, you go there and you leave your data all the time. Do you realize it? And if they say, we keep them, now they say how long they keep it. Before they were not. They say 18 months. It makes me thinking about all the struggle that had been in the libraries, where some libraries, many libraries in some countries were requested to note who was looking at which books. Thank you. Excuse me. So if you put it on those search engines, it's the same problem. And we really think in Europe that 18 months to keep all what you do, all what you search, the way you make your own mind through searching information, this is not a guarantee for your freedom of information. It is much too much. That's the principle of proportionality. In this case, 18 months is surely, from our perspective, much too excessive in front of the freedom of information. Also, the profiling. Well, Simon was saying it's not transparent, and we don't know what they do. We're going to find out. They have to tell us what they do, the profile. Do the people have any right about their profile? Can they escape from it? Is there a right to oppose to that? Do they have right of access? That would be normal to have the right of access to their profile. Is it implemented? That's another question. That's the kind of question we have with the new services coming. This panel was also about security, collective security. I don't know how you want to manage. Maybe if it will be for questions, but I would like... You want me to say? Okay. The more you have massive systems with very sensitive information, the more there may be attraction. Attraction, they attract people, not only for advertisement, but can be also for law enforcement, for spyings, for things like that. We have to think about that. What is the limit? There are, as for any human rights, there are limits. And also for data protection, there are limits for the social collective security. But how big are those derogations implemented? For the last years, since 2001, it's true that it had been too far, and we have been saying it nationally, but it was not under our decision, it was under the parliament decisions. And the two worst cases, I'm sorry, because they don't involve Europe, they involve Europe, but they came not from Europe, but we may have the same problem in the future. The worst cases have been the PNR question and the SWIFT question. The derogation from the safety purpose went up to the fact that the whole files could be in the hand of security services. This is a huge and too much derogation, and we have been surprised that very few people were talking about that. Even the private sector, those files were in the private sector. The commercial files, and you didn't see much said publicly. We were the only one, the data protection authorities, able to talk loudly about that and saying it goes too far. It And for the PNR, we might have a PNR in Europe, and we are already saying that it should be much reduced from the perspective that we had been, I mean, Europe had accepted from US. Facing the two waves that we are living for the moment, security, as you saw during this conference, much emphasis was on cybercrime. We endorse cybercrime, but we think that first we need to have the right to data protection set up. And it's only enforced in less than 50 countries for today. Huh? So that's the first problem. We have to spread data protection and making it recognized on international level. The more people will know their rights, the more the derogation when we are in a security period will be much balanced. Huh? The more we, in all of us, knows our rights, the more we think that the shortage will be the less, and that's why we have programs. We all as DPAs in the world took the view that we need to make big programs with education and also towards our parliaments. What is the reality? They don't know always. That is called the London Initiative. On the wage, the waves of new technologies, which comes very fast, about 80% of new technologies we use today were not on the market 10 years ago. There is a huge need for making much more dialogue with the industry. For instance, it's not normal that a service like Google has at least 31 services, and we are starting only the dialogue with them. So it should be much more focused and timely, with agenda, so we can discuss with them. The challenge in the world today is, and Google and Microsoft said, we need world standards. I understand them. Because if they work, if the same services is applied in all countries, they need to have general standards on the world. We were the first 2-3 years ago, just before the SMEC, as DPAs, to say we need world standards. We know what they can are through the papers Anne Carblanc was talking about, but they are not binding on world level. So there is, I mean, nowadays, we are not any longer in the 19s. We need some kind of binding principles on a world level. And this might be crucial for the future if we go with more and more technologies going in privacy. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie, for that presentation. We're fortunate to have Carlos Gregorio, who showed up for this panel. I'll just quickly give you his biography. Carlos is the research director at the Research Institute for Justice in Argentina. For over 3 years, he's been the coordinator of a project to generate awareness amongst the Latin American and Caribbean judiciaries on how to protect the personal information on their websites. He consulted previously to the Inter-American Children's Institute, part of the Organization of American States, the APC Monitor Project of Internet Rights, and was an advisor to numerous government and development institutions in Latin America, Africa, and Europe. Professor Gregorio?
Thank you. Sorry for the delay. My problem is I don't know exactly what you are speaking about. But let me speak for a minute about some problem that there exists in Latin America. The problem is about the balance of equilibrium between data protection and dissemination of judicial information. In Latin America, like no other region in the world, judiciaries launch very powerful websites including two kinds of informations. One, application for the case law, and other application for the case management. In both applications, in the vast majority of the countries in Latin America, there is also the possibility to use search engines, and the search engines allows the use of personal names. What means this? This means that you enter a name or a security number in the search engine of the website of the judiciary, and you retrieve cases like this, carriers of HIV, and there is a country in Latin America that has all the people that are carriers of HIV, victims of, for instance, of rape, sexual exploitation, and others. This is one kind of problem. The other kind of problem is the dissemination of the labor court's information. What is the problem? The problem is that the companies that selection of personnel, human resources companies, use these websites to investigate if a people, particular worker, that apply for a position has in the past an historial of claims made against the employer. If a people make it an action for the rest of life, don't get an employer. Why we have this problem? The main problem are legal gaps. In Latin America, only two or three countries are adequate data protection law. And transparency is a priority for the judiciaries in Latin America. And for this reason, the line that followed the judicial branch was in to make transparency and don't worry about the privacy rights. I need to add some data. In Mexico, there is a company. The company is Bill.mx. That means Bureau of Legal Investigations. This company downloads every day all the information that publish the judiciaries, the tribunals, and courts in Mexico, compact it in a CD, and also offer access to subscribers in the internet online. The main problem of all of this is discrimination about mainly labor and credit and all the things that we don't know. This is the main problem about privacy rights and data protection in Latin America. Another example, the Costa Rica Supreme Court has one claim a week from people that say that their privacy rights are violated by the judicial power, the judicial branch. And this is very curious. Is the same people that solve the case are the climate people. In Costa Rica, we have the advantage that the Supreme Court condemned itself every time. This is good, but not is the same in Mexico, in Chile, where the Supreme Court said, no, I have the reason, it's all okay. Okay, this is to introduce, in my point of view, the paradigm of broke data protection in Latin America.
Thank you very much. So as you can tell from the discussion so far, this is a very tense and complicated, but incredibly exciting field. It's so complicated that I have, for example, here's the annual report from the Electronic Privacy Information Center called Privacy and Human Rights. It is massive now, and what it documents is the nature of privacy and privacy protections around the world and privacy threats. And there are some copies available at the back of the room for those who are interested. This is how complex privacy and data protection actually is. And so that's why I've always been amazed that it's generally been neglected within the IGF and the WSIS discussions when there's so much rich information and rich debate that can be had, such as the debate we've had today so far. Without further ado, I'm going to open up questions to the audience, who can pose questions to a single panelist or all the panelists together. But please announce your name and who you are addressing your questions to. So are there any questions? Thank you. I'll bring you the mic.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Wolfgang Benedek from University of Graz in Austria. We have the problem that privacy is increased, restricted or limited through anti-terrorist measures, anti-crime measures, and so on, so from the security field. And this is something I think one can cope with because it's clear how and why these restrictions are taking place. But we also see the development that, as Mrs. George said, people expose themselves, young people expose themselves. They go on YouTube, they go on Facebook, and so on. And this raises for me the question, are we observing a different culture developing with regard to data protection? Because the old conventions from the 90s and so on, they are quite strong. But is it that young people today see still a purpose for that if they are acting as they are acting? And how to deal with this? Is this just an issue of awareness creation, or is this a deeper social cultural issue? Because if we lose, so to say, the awareness or the insight, why do we need this at all, then we will not have a very strong support when we deal with industry, with states, and so on. And the second question, there is a proposal which I have not heard here, that there should be a general agreement of deleting of data after a certain time in order to get rid of this problem altogether. Because the different storage times which we have cannot be controlled. And so the question is, shouldn't there be a general rule that everybody who is keeping data in the public field has to delete them in order to get rid of that? It's so difficult to delete data these days, so you have to make an additional effort, it seems.
Thank you for all these questions, and I'm not sure my English is enough, so maybe I didn't understand everything. First thing, general rules. When I was talking about the search engine, in my view, it wouldn't be normal if they could compete on question of privacy, I would say. So I wish we have a general rule for them. Huh? So they can't say we are better because we keep them only 1 month, or we are not good because we keep them more. It should be the same time. About the children which expose themselves. For the moment, we think that it's more a question of education. We have to educate our children for a lot of things, and also for that. School, parents, and I can assure you that from some experience, it's terrible because sometimes they need to have the problem before they understand. But once a child has a young person has a child has a problem because they publicize themselves too much with job and everything, this is known all around them, and they don't do it any longer. So it's true that the way we educate children, but I can tell you that they can understand very much. There is a very interesting study in America about the privacy, how children see their privacy. It's very interesting, and they have a privacy. It's not true to think that they don't have, and they want to be exposed all the time, and so forth. This is not true at all. But the way it's true that some services show themselves, if they say, you are going to find your friends, that you lost friends, Well, it's not exactly that. Also, the story is not only that. We have to tell them that it's not only that. So that's the question I understood. Thank you.
Just one observation. I think it's very tempting to imagine that somehow human nature has changed and there's something different about the context of human interaction in Web 2.0. Actually, it's interesting looking back through how people were obsessed about promoting themselves on television. Before that, there was talkback radio in its era. Before that, the Victorian soapbox, you know, which occurred in every pub and inn and field. I don't think much has changed, but of course it's the scale and the nature of the technology. But I think humans have always demonstrated this you know, insatiable thirst for promotion. And they've done it, you know, from the playground to the sort of photocopy machine, you know, down the decades and the centuries. But one thing I would say is, and you touched on this a little, I think one of the big questions that we have to confront and address very, very shortly is this dilemma over what personal information should be regarded as open or searchable. And right at the moment, industry generally says, well, no, if it's personal information and you publish in one realm, then it should be available to be published in multiple media forms in multiple realms. And I'm not entirely sure that this is the right way to go. It's possible that what we're looking for here is a technological solution to wrap personal information in a sort of, DRM, personal DRM way, that we can then maintain some sort of control and exercise some limitation over its longevity and its distribution. And when I mentioned before that communication with industry is just beginning, perhaps one of the things we want to see is industry focus more on the idea of user control at that core level as it wraps around personal information.
Thank you. Just a few words. Does it work?
Yeah, just start speaking.
Just a few words to say that awareness of children of what can happen is something important, but we shouldn't see the devil everywhere. There's a need for the development of a culture of privacy on the side of the users, but also on the side of those businesses who are currently proposing very attractive websites where young teenagers and even adults, there are several OECD staff members who have who have now their information on Facebook, for instance. And I don't see why it should be a choice like either you go and you put your privacy at risk or you don't go. So a culture of privacy is something that needs to be spread around. We had earlier a panel on malware and someone was pointing to this wonderful sentence, developing a culture of security, which the OECD has been using and works pretty well. Because it's informal, it's not something that is prescribed, it's something that people need to integrate. It's like when you go on a plane and you switch off your mobile, until the rules change maybe, but everybody understands that currently it's important that you don't create any interference with the waves on which the plane is interacting. Thank you.
Thanks for that great question. If I could just add one little thing. I recently heard a fact from Facebook where they said they've developed privacy settings for their accounts, and they were disappointed that only 25% of Facebook users actually use those privacy settings. I think that's actually quite amazing that 25% of users have shown a preference about controlling access to their own personal information. That's a very promising development. So when you hear of companies like Google and Microsoft developing systems where individuals can choose how information gets used, that's again a very promising development. If you link that to what Simon's talking about with using digital rights management, the future isn't as bleak as is often foreseen. The next question at the back from Jan Schellenberg.
Yeah, hello. Jan Schellenberg, legal researcher for a privacy commissioner in the north of Germany. I wanted to raise two issues and start with one that has been raised by Professor Benedict just a while ago, and then answered by Simon Day with raising the matter of DRM, which I was really happy to hear, because I've been promoting that for about a year now to different fora, that could be a viable way to go, since free flow of information may not be the right paradigm for personal identifiable information. And that also could give some part of the solution to the question that was just raised, because it boils it down to the question of a principle that we already have, that's the principle of purpose binding. So if we use Facebook and the like, social networks, we might be able to beforehand say, well, we want this information to be spread within a specific community with access for certain people, but not beyond that, and we don't want this to be stored forever, but this is to be deleted after, say, 2 years, 3 years or something. This could be part of a solution to that problem. So we don't want cementized public available data. And there is another asset to that, and that could be interesting for a company like Google and a lot of others. That is the question that Simon has just raised by stating that there is a need for transparency for the consumer. So using those kind of approaches, there would be a possibility for companies to not only state, but to some extent give proof that they're following and complying to the privacy rules. They are either legally needed to do, or that they want to do. So, but the other aspect that I wanted to raise, and I was also happy to hear about that, and that is something I've been struggling with. I just recently did a research on linkability of digital identities, and something we haven't really been able to cope with in the from a legal perspective is the matter of aggregation, and that is certainly something we don't really get our hands on yet. The problem there is that we're not talking about PII, personal identifiable data, in the sense that most of the definitions go for, but still it creates some intricacies with the matter of self-determination as a principle, and there's market imbalances that come along with that. And since this has been raised, it would be great if you could extend a little bit more on that as well.
One thing I'd say in response, it's delightful that you're doing this research, because this is something which, this is where I get optimistic for a change. If we take a look at the cryptographic infrastructure, we could not imagine the cryptographic solutions that we have now 10 years ago. It would have been inconceivable that you could have that level of security. And I'm sure that if there was a consensus, Google talks of international consensus, I think this is where we could agree. If we could find an infrastructure solution that could help wrap and secure and control personal data, then we can have the best of both worlds. We can have a very efficient transparency and availability of data and the maximization of privacy protection. But it requires investment and cooperation. But I think that's the next big step. If we can just take that step, I frankly think that many of the discussion points we've had today can be resolved. Sort of, it's just a question of how long. Yes.
Hello, my name is Nikos Nastos, and I'm working from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Greece. But I have a personal question, not. My question is, nowadays there are a lot of applications that require biometrical data, fingerprints, and so on. What's the legislation about this? What steps have been made from the countries and also from the private sector, like Google and all these companies, so as to preserve this data and not to distribute this data? Thank you.
The medical data is something which has been a grave concern for a while. I'm aware that, for example, I'm not sure, maybe Gus, you're more aware of the Microsoft proposal than I am, the Microsoft system for health data. Do you want to address that for a second? Because in terms of protections, we've got the technology running before the protections.
Well, this is another case of I wish companies were better at making their points about how they are protective of privacy. Microsoft recently announced something called Health Vault, which is to store your medical records online. It's particularly geared to the U.S. market, and they promise that there are very careful security safeguards involved, but we haven't seen what they are. But that's a great example of what's this move away from personal information residing in specific places, such as your computer or your doctor's office, and moving to other places where it's accessible. And I do believe that, as Joanna was saying, there are a lot of engineers who are working really hard who can get some really interesting solutions out there that can protect privacy and enhance security at the same time. I remain to be convinced that the jury's still out whether Microsoft has done this, but there are other firms in this field, and they're all rushing towards medical data. Another situation is in the United Kingdom, where the government has decided to centralize all medical records in a single database that will be available for access by over 400,000 civil servants across the country. Not only is this a technological nightmare to develop this system, but of course there are inherent security risks and, of course, privacy risks that emerge. Again, we have not seen much research done in this field, and I look forward to more happening in that area. And then, the final example, when you look at, say, biometric data and the mass accumulation of biometric data by governments particularly, but also by some members of the private sector, again, you have a significant security problem that arises. Recently, the big news in the United Kingdom today or yesterday was that the UK government had outsourced the collection of visa information to a private company, and this private company made visa application information available on the web to applicants. That's relevant to your post in the Foreign Office. And they got fined by the national regulator in the United Kingdom for breaching privacy. Fortunately, they haven't yet implemented biometric data, but that's exactly the type of risks that we run as we move towards fingerprinting at borders and other types of systems like that. Does anybody else want to?
In France, there is a huge project for medical data. Your dossier, individual dossier, could be digitalized and accessible by doctors you visit. It is not generalized at all. There is only some tests, and it is under review. We are, as DPA, we are accompanying this project at each step. For instance, we had to take a decision about the fact that are those files will be identified by a national number, which is also used for social security and so forth. The CNIL said no, it has to be a specific one. There is a question of the right to for the individual to shadow some information. If you go to see someone for your eyes, do you have to say that you had been pregnant or not and so forth, kind of things. So this is not completely solved yet, but patient associations are much asking for that, and we agree also on that. So there is a certain number of problems that can be raised, and the good thing is if you have some kind of independent data protection authority which can follow this kind of projects, and ask the right question at the right moment, because at the beginning you don't see everything, and as the project goes on, you can ask new questions and make consultations with industry, with patients, and so forth.
Okay. Hello. I have a question from Mary. You speak about biometrics data related to fingerprints, eyes, register, etc. And in general terms, biometric data are personal data. Do you think that this kind of data must have a specific protection or legislation related to treatment or processing or storage of this data?
In this field, in France, it's a class of data processing which is considered as risky. So they are under authorization of the CNIL, in the private sector especially. We developed a policy. We have to review it all the time. Not review, change, but be more precise. First, we make a distinction between two kind of biometrics. One related to features you have, which those you leave traces everywhere. That's fingerprint. You put your finger, here I am. Also DNA. And more also the face. But there are others you don't leave traces, like the shape of your hand. You don't leave the shape of your hand. The Japanese made something very clever. The design of the vein of your finger or hand, you don't leave these kind of things. Also your eyes, up to now, you don't leave traces. When the picture, the photo, the camera will be more powerful, they may be able to go inside your eyes, I don't know, but for the moment. So we make a difference between these two. And we can allow use of biometrics without those which are, you don't leave traces for certain things. But for the others, we ask for very high security problems. For instance, nuclear environment, things like that. You may use the fingerprints. Of course, we didn't decide yet about the project of identification card that is supposed to have fingerprints. But the decision, I mean, there had been decision on the European level to have a passport with fingerprints in it. But it is not implemented yet, and it is not decided. We will see. But the main thing is to see that there are two different, very different things. And also, even for those biometrics from the fingerprints, it is completely different if you use two fingers to identify someone that you have in front of you. You are here, so you. Or if you take the ten fingerprints of someone. 10 fingerprints mean that it will be a police file to find someone in any crime system. So it is completely different. And in one country I know where they take for the identification card the 10 fingerprints, what happened? You find people assassinated with cut. Their hands are cut.
Thank you. Biometrics are unique. Some of them, you're right, Marie, you're leaving traces with your fingerprints, but you don't leave traces with your iris. Nevertheless, they're all unique, these informations, and so they may deserve a special treatment. Second, they may deserve a special treatment also because the quality of their capture needs to be ensured. Because when there is a problem with the use of biometrics, which are unique, and there is some kind of compromission, you're in trouble. So you also need to have something to back up the automatic recognition of those biometrics. You need to have a human intervention. You need to have backup processes. So I would say generally, it would be important to reserve a special treatment from the capture of the information until the use and the sharing of that information for these categories of data. And then we talked about the use of biometrics in passports. As soon as an information can be read at a distance, it can also be stored on a system, and then it can be sent around. So I won't say more, but...
Yves Poulet from University of Namur, expert for the Council of Europe. I was thinking about the question, Simon, you have raised before, the different people representative of the business community. The question was, what is privacy? I think it is normal that nobody can give the right definition of what is privacy. What is privacy is different from one people to another people. I think the fundamental question is not this one. The fundamental question is, why do we need privacy? And the only answer, quite interesting, I found, is definitely the answer given by the Federal German Constitutional Court in 83. They have said quite correctly that we need privacy not because we are owner of our personal data. That's not the reason why we need privacy. We need privacy because privacy is a condition for the self-development of each citizen. What does it mean? It means that without privacy, without the right to intimacy, without the right to control the use of your data, it is impossible to self-develop yourself. And the self-development is a condition for a citizen to become really an authentic citizen, for participating totally in a democratic society, expressing his own opinion and defending his own cause. And I think the link between privacy and democracy must be done very clearly. I think that's in that sense that we have to think about. I think that privacy is, in that sense, the fundamental human right, because it is a condition of all other freedom. Otherwise, you will be subject to a certain number of logic embedded, for example, in certain information system. I don't like to receive publicity which are profiled according to the profile decided by a computer. I prefer to receive publicity precisely for entering into new worlds. If it is only for confirming my present personality, I have no chance to develop new ideas, new opinion. And that's, from my opinion, the main reason why we need privacy. But perhaps you have other remark and other suggestion or other ideas there about.
Should have been here. Yeah.
Thanks for that. Just very briefly, recognizing also the time, I think the problem is your references, the way you set that out, excellent, brilliant, and I agree 100%. I think the problem is that we're facing is that we have a sexy new industry that tends to imagine that we have to reinvent the wheel. We have to go back and redefine. We have a media and politicians who very often are captivated. They're seduced because of this new media, this new industry. And they too say, well, things have changed. Things have moved on. We need to look at new definitions and new approaches. And this is the problem. You know, and you get this triangulation of interests that asks for a redefinition. And 1983, oh my God, that's ancient history. Yeah. You know, this is the problem time and time again. And you talk to voters, you talk to people in pubs, and they start to say the same thing. Oh yeah, but yeah, that's an old definition. Now we've got Facebook, you know. So I think that's where, I think it's the dynamics of the conversation and the politics. This is where it's going to get interesting. We have to hold on to the sort of definition framework that you were describing.
Let me just I wasn't going to respond, but I just wanted to say that there are significant new technologies and new ways and cross-border, you know, implications by this data. But since he refrained from picking on me last time, and since he just called our industry sexy, then I will let it stand.
Okay, we got to close off.
Some of those very important new service says in newspapers that when they scan an email to find words very interesting to put advertisement, like I am going to Morocco, and so they put something about Morocco. It says that it is not interception. It is not personal data. They don't look, nobody look at it. So it is not interception, it is not personal data or processing. What do you think?
Okay.
Definition of what is interception.
Okay, so unfortunately we can't take any more questions. We have run over on time. I'm sorry about that. If we could ask you to thank our panelists today, they've been provide us with a very rich and colorful picture of the situation for privacy and security around the world. So thank you to the panelists. Thank you. And if you have any further questions, you could always address them outside as we try to move on for the next panel to come in. Thank you very much.